When you're asked, can I have headphones, Paul? I hear this hum in my phones. Is there any reason? It's probably just the phones, right? Okay. Tape rolling? When you're asked what tribe you're from, do you still answer other?
Well, the other thing I wrote in relation to intergroup relationships in the United States, because in the 60s and early 70s, the blacks made such a tremendous impact on American consciousness that when people were describing or grouping the poor or disadvantaged or any of those other terms, they'd always say, well, you got blacks and Mexican-Americans and others. And so you had to sort out who others were, and it turned out to be Indians and Asians and Basques and Puerto Ricans. I think that it pretty well disappeared as a result of a lot of Indian activism. It never was a important element inside the Indian community because everybody knew what tribe everybody else was from. In fact, if you go into Indian communities, you can check out a person's Indian ancestry very quickly because almost everybody knows where the different reservations are, where the villages are in a reservation. And in the post-war years, we've had enough meetings and enough interchange between tribes. And if you were to come tell me you were a certain tribe, I'd know the reservation, I'd know the villages. I'd pin you down to what village you were in and what family in the village. And
Do a lot of people say they're Indian when they're really not?
Yeah, a lot of people say they're Indian. They can sometimes even identify what tribe they're supposed to be. And so you just press them and you say, well, what village are you from? And, you know, what family within that village? Who are your relatives? And you can distinguish them pretty easily. In fact, I never had trouble with government undercover agents when I was an activist because I'd sit down, I'd make them tell me where they thought they were from. And sooner or later, I'd trip them up because I knew so many Indians because I'd been so active. I knew families in just about every Indian community in the country. And one government agent said he was a Huma from Louisiana. And so I pinned him down. There's about maybe 30 little fishing villages in the Bayou country in Louisiana. And he just guessed the wrong village and the wrong group. And I knew right away that he wasn't what he pretended to be. later on in New York, when I was working with some of the attorneys there, this guy showed up, and immediately the attorneys got very uptight, and they said he's the FBI undercover agent that covers minorities in South Manhattan. So I'd pinned him down pretty well.
What are some reasons other people would have who aren't agents for pretending like they were from Indian heritage when they weren't?
Well, a lot of people get dissatisfied with their own lives and think it's more romantic to be Indian and try and become Indians. In fact, there's a serious debate going on right now among Indians because the 70 census showed almost 800,000 Indians, and the 80 census showed 1.4 million Indians. And that's almost a 200% increase in 10 years. And a lot of us attribute it to the fact that there are a lot of whites who decided they wanted to be Indians and identified themselves as Indians on the 80 census. You couldn't conceivably have a population double in 10 years.
Could it be that Indians who hadn't participated in the census are now?
No, because we had a fairly good jump of about 200,000 between 1960 and 1970. And we attribute that to the emergence of Eastern Indians who had identified kind of as other in the census before. And now, because of the activism and because of the high Indian profile, had again come out and advocate or, you know, articulated their tribal heritage. During the 60s, we identified close to 80 remnant communities in the eastern states that you know, are actual descendants of bands of Indians who used to live here and were never sent west during the big removal. And I've talked to a number of them, and I'm satisfied with the authenticity of their claims. And so we attribute the big rise between 60 and 70 to the fact those people, you know, forcefully identified as American Indians. But between 70 and 80, where you get almost 700,000 new Indians, an awful lot of that has to be white people that decided they wanted to be Indians.
in the 60s, especially in countercultural circles, Indian life became very romanticized in Indian lore and religion, and the relationship of the Indians to the earth became something that a lot of people wanted to learn more about and follow the ways of. I get the impression you think that was ultimately more of a curse than anything else to Indians.
Oh, not so much a curse. I think that there was a positive interest in kind of finding roots again in terms of relationship to land. What I was disappointed in was that it didn't seem to be as deep as it might have been. See, what you're really talking about, I think in Indian sense, is maintaining some kind of balance between yourself and your environment. And that includes people and animals and the land. And if people had really understood that, then I think we would have had a lot better ecological movement in terms of cleaning up the environment, you know, the city environment. Where we've seen it in the Southwest is in Chicano burials. They're doing a lot of mural painting, and they're starting to, you know, make the barrio just almost kind of center of Chicano cultural life. You know, we haven't seen that in other places, and you know, if you'd really understood the, you know, Indians don't go out in the morning and kiss chipmunks or anything like that. See, but it is a kind of way to feel at home in the environment. And we wish there'd been more acknowledgement of that.
You've been involved in many political and social actions. You're the former director of the National Congress of American Indians. How do you think the kind of political action that is effective now compares to the kind of action that was effective 10 or 15 years ago? Is there a different kind of tactic that you think has to be developed now or is being developed now?
Well, I don't think there's anything very effective at the present time. In the 60s, the reason things were effective is that there was the first time television really tried to cover domestic events. And when people would have protests, the media would rush down there and highlight it, so it would always be on the evening news. And so protests, I think by the early 70s, became a form of entertainment and not a political thing. And I had a lot of discussions with Indian activists regarding overuse of the visual media to get across the message. The March on Washington 64 was well covered, and they had, I don't know, 400,000 people at the reflecting pool, and, you know, it was a big event. When Indians went in 72 to occupy the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they got some coverage, but it really didn't become the kind of event the 64 was. Then in 78, they had this longest march down to Washington. They got virtually no coverage at all. It's kind of like a situation comedy that runs too long, and pretty soon no one wants to see it. But it's very difficult to get the rank-and-file activists who kind of got their identity and their glory in the days television covered them completely to leave that tactic and get on to something else. The thing I advocate today is pretty thorough research and a mastery of the issues, and then a direct negotiation with your opponents over a solution to some problems. I think a lot of problems have been well articulated in the last 20 years, but the adversary parties have not really sat down and got to the bottom of it. So I think there's a lot of people my age that went through the activist phase and are now getting a lot of things done in terms of negotiation because, you know, both sides are pretty well made with their position is clear to the other side. So there's no sense having symbolic protests or occupations because it's all done to attract public sympathy. And a lot of issues are refined to the point where they're too complicated to be easily disseminated and understood by the general public anyway. So it's much better to sit down and negotiate things and keep the activism as a last resort. So if you won't negotiate on a meaningful basis, then we'll have to do something.
Do you think that the media coverage and the activism of the past decade had made it possible to now sit down and negotiate with opposing parties?
Well, it certainly laid the groundwork and set up an emotional situation where neither party wants to go through the tedious expenditure of energy for activism. But I think Americans are becoming much more aware of the complexity of the problems that face them, and so that's just as important in terms of resolving things. I think people are finally taking certain things seriously.
What do you consider to be the key issues now for Native Americans?
Well, I consider in this generation the production of kind of an intellectual elite for Indians that can stand up and interpret things. Now, a lot of other people are more active in the field of natural resources. And so they're doing a lot of water rights work, strip mining, all the things that get popular attention. But it seems to me that that's a limited perspective because you raise the initial question, should we do this or not? And nobody seems to be able to take the discussion beyond that point. So the people who want to exploit the land ruthlessly almost always win because they say, well, we have to have this to keep society going, so we're going to have to do it anyway. So what had become good reasons for not exploiting certain minerals or resources always get overwhelmed by the expediency of the fact that society as a whole needs these things. What we really need is a group of Indians that can speak meaningfully to the non-Indian world and yet feel comfortable in the traditions of the tribe and are able to see the traditions of the tribe as a sophisticated alternative to the way they're expected to act in white society. And we're doing this in kind of fits and starts. And I think it's very important to focus our attention back on communities rather than the federal government. In 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed. And this is a bureaucratic attempt to preserve the Indian children who have to be adopted in kind of allow the tribe to have some say in the foster homes or adoption situation. Now, to me, it's a stopgap measure that was supported by a majority of Indians because they wanted the federal government to intervene in the adoption of Indian children. There was a tremendous loss of children on the reservations. But what we really need are Indian spokesmen to stand up to the Indian community and say, look, we don't need a bureaucratic law. We need to put the kinship system back together and the clans back together. We need to take care of these people ourselves. And so just moving from the perception that an institution can help you or the perception that people can help you. And that's a very important philosophical movement. And we don't have the spokesman for the other side. And we need to develop those if we're going to continue. There's no sense developing a large mineral resource if the majority of your children are being adopted by white parents and taken to Connecticut or Pennsylvania or California. I mean, what are you talking about? You're not, you know, preserving the people into the tribe. You're only exploiting the resources of the land they own.
Is one of the issues that Indians are dealing with now how much to keep or how much to research and readapt of traditions?
You know, people are not facing that directly. what we find happening is they kind of take the word of white institutions that these people know what they're doing. And they get far enough into them and far enough committed to them that they think this is a solution. And then they suddenly discover that it's not the solution. They then just completely drop out of white society, but they still got those white ideas in their head, so they can't really get back into Indian society. So we get this kind of restless group. And it kind of spans all age groups. You got very young people, and you got people my age, and you got people older that, you know, suddenly become disillusioned with the institutions.
Which institutions do you mean?
Colleges and universities, mm-hmm. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, the State Civil Rights Commission, you know, big corporations. And they adopt the ethics and identity of those groups and work very hard. And one day they suddenly come to themselves that this group is not helping to solve problems. And they're too far into it to give it up right away. And they just become lost. Now, we really need to have Indians who've either gone through that process and then gone back to tribal life, or Indians who didn't go into process because they suspected it from the beginning. And have them kind of articulate a modern Indianism so people can feel they have something to cling to.
Is that what you're trying to do now, to articulate a modern Indianism?
Yeah, it's pretty close to it. And I think there's some very helpful or very hopeful signs. The recent Navajo election, where Peterson Zah beat Peter McDonald, who had been the incumbent for 12 years. Zah represents a whole new aspect of things. He's one Navajo, well-educated, but he never trusted any institution other than traditional Navajo life. See, he knew how to deal with it because he headed legal aid on the reservation for a number of years. He knows the court system. He knows the U.S. political system. But he never thought any of those were real. Whereas McDonald thought he was going to be the King Saudi of strip mining in the country. And he kept saying Indians are Arabs and we ought to hold the United States up for all the money we can get for our coal. Peterson Zah has the attitude that the land belongs to Navajos. And the Navajos, the first duty is to see that the people have the land the way they want to use it. And then if we have to generate income over and above that, then we'll consider development. See?
When someone feels like they want to return to tribal society or tribal culture, how much of it is left? What is there to return to now?
Well, what I've been trying to get Indians to see is that the cultures add and subtract rituals and ceremonies and beliefs as they go through time and have different experiences. So that there are a lot of Indians in the urban areas that they drop out of the urban area and they go back to the reservation. And they want to, you know, live like people lived 40 or 50 years ago. And you keep trying to get them to relax. They've been in white society so long that they're very tense when they go back and they want to basically recreate the days of their childhood. On a lot of reservations, you have all-reservation basketball tournaments. You have Indians are getting into the media. They're starting to get radio stations and they have video cassettes. So I look at modern Indian communities as a combination of old and new. And I think it's perfectly all right to have an Indian basketball tournament 2 days after you have some religious dance or ceremony. I mean, because it's what's meaningful to people. And trying to get newly returned Indians to feel comfortable with the fact that the reservation communities have adopted a lot of things of modern society because, you know, they've seen them and they like them. And why not do this? People returning are often very purist about tradition and they give an overemphasis to it. It's a good thing in a way because it helps reservation people who've always been traditional. It gives them a big boost that, you know, that there's a large group of newcomers that's been away from the reservation 25, 30, 40 years. They want to come back and reemphasize a lot of the old things. So it gives a boost to traditionalism on the reservation. At the same time, it creates some frictions because a lot of times the people that return are very intolerant of the majority of the community that does things that every other rural American community would do. They'd say a bake sale was the white man's way of doing things. Well, it's just a rural way of raising money. It's a good social event. I mean, there's no profound cultural change implications there. And so you get those kind of tensions where people returning want to identify this is Indian and that is white. People live in a community all the time just identify things by this is what we're going to do next, and you know, the community likes to do this, so we're going to do it.
If you're just joining us, Vine Deloria is my guest, and he's the author of Custer Died for Your Sins, We Talk, You Listen, former executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, and now a professor of political science at the University of Arizona, where he teaches federal Indian policy. in your own life, could you talk with us about how what part in your life Indian tradition fits into? And maybe that sounds too compartmentalized, but I mean, you're in an academic institution, which, as we all know, is loaded with bureaucratic rules and regulations to follow, and it's an academic institution. Do you feel connected to Indian tradition while you're working or in your home life?
Well, I've been away from the reservation since 1951, which is a long time. What I remember of the traditions is the way reservations were before World War II, which was when I really, you know, saw most of the traditional rural life. And a lot of the tradition that stays with me comes over those years since I left the reservation, when I've learned knowledge in an academic way, either working on a lawsuit or working with different tribes around the country, or reading books that help me call into question certain academic beliefs of Western society. So I've gone back and tried to talk with tribal elders and traditional people about, you know, what was really the way people did things and what were the meaning of things. So that I think subsequent experiences trying to deal with the white world in informational sense, it gave me a much clearer appreciation of the solidity of the Indian tradition. And as a consequence, the more information I've gathered, the more skillful I've been in dealing with white society, the more acceptable I've become to the traditional elements of the communities. And in a 15-year period, I've kind of gone from the fair-haired boy or the favorite of the tribal councils to the favorite of the traditionals. And it's because I've become increasingly aware of the informal, customary ways Indians solve problems, as opposed to bureaucratic or activist or political way that you solve problems out in the larger world. So in turn, I've tried to talk with traditional people and help them see that perpetuating the traditions is the finest gift they can give the next generation of Indians, that they don't have to be ashamed to practice some of the things. So it's been an instance of just having childhood memories, and then as I gather more knowledge, you know, having traditional people kind of help me place that knowledge in a place where it's meaningful to me. So I know a lot of traditional people from a lot more tribes than my own.
Are there instances in your life, looking back, that you can really point to as being really significant in your becoming an activist?
Well, for a while in the late 70s, and probably today, an awful lot of Indians were jealous of me because I'd had a leadership position, and white people recognized me, or at least said that I was an Indian spokesman. After I left National Congress of American Indians, I tried not to be a spokesman so much as a commentator. But in the early 70s, there was a really intense jealousy among Indians who were recognized by white society as outstanding Indian community. So I went through a lot of hard times with particularly Indians in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and some of the national organizations. It got very vicious. I had very vicious, slanderous attacks leveled at me by other Indians. I found out part of it was part of FBI COINTELPRO to try and knock out my credibility during the Wounded Knee trials. And so I discounted some of that. But the situation was that in the early 60s, you know, I was really naive and idealistic. And we get in situations where every Indian in the audience knew what the right thing was, but no one wanted to stand up and say, hey, look, we don't want any of this. This is what we want. And a number of times, whether it was right or wrong, in some instances, I know it was right, in other instances, probably wrong. When no one would get up and say anything, I'd get up and say, hey, look, we don't want any of that. And then all the Indians would quickly agree with me. So it became a case where certain types of leadership fell to me by default just because I had the guts to get up and say, you know, this is the reality of it. No, we don't want this. That was particularly true in 68 when the government had this great big legislative proposal that would have put mortgages on Indian lands. None of the Indians wanted it, but no one would get up and say, we don't want it. So the government kept having meetings, and the Indians kept getting up and saying, we want to study this, give us more time. And I kept telling them, just tell them you don't like the legislation, that we don't want it. Don't say give us more time, because they'll call us together 3 months from now and say, okay, you've had time to look at it, now we're going to go through with it. So I kind of got in a leadership position where whenever there's really a hard problem, people would come to me and say, you go get up. And it was, you know, Vine always has to go bell the cat because the rest of us are running around like mice. So I can see where a lot of the jealousy came from, because these people wanted to stand up and say it. They didn't have the guts to. And when I stood up and said it and was then looked at by white society as a prominent leader and a political theoretician, then they'd get jealous because they wanted to say it all along, but they just didn't have the courage to get up and do it. So it became a very traumatic situation. When they started the occupation of the Bureau and occupation of Wounded Knee, occupation of that monastery up in Wisconsin, all kinds of people called me and said, you go out and, you know, stand in the middle and bring these two groups together and help them get, you know, help them solve this problem before any more people get killed. And I pointed out that I've done this almost 10 years, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life standing between two groups of people that got guns and don't know whether how the situation going to turn out. And I said, I've gotten out of law school now, and I know a great deal about Indian treaties, and I'd rather be expert witness and scholarly consultant that could come in and articulate very complicated issues. I don't want to be out there just trying to say, fellas, let's make peace. And I said, that's a young man's game. And the only way some of these people are really going to earn their spurs as leaders is to get out there and do that. And if I have any contribution now, because I've got so much experience, it should be as an expert witness. And the Indians, during the Wounded Knee occupation, a lot of them were mad at me because I didn't get a rifle and go to Wounded Knee. And so I had a big confrontation with some of them in Washington. And I said, if I get a rifle and go to Wounded Knee, I'll end up as a defendant. If I stay out of it and you go to trial and they subpoena me, I can come in and give testimony on the treaty and I can be an expert witness. I can help you win some of these cases. Now, if all the Indians in the world are defendants, there's going to be no one to say, this is why we did it. See? So Russell Means didn't understand that. And there were kind of hard feelings between the two of us until his trial came up. And then Dee Brown and I were subpoenaed as witnesses. I went and I found a way to get the 68 treaty introduced into the trial. And we discussed it. And then out in the courtroom after I'd given testimony, he came up to me and he said, I finally understand what you meant. That if you'd been a defendant, you couldn't have gotten on the stand and told the truth about the treaty. And so there really are two ways and maybe more to work on things. So I guess the trauma or the turning point you're talking about are just all those little meetings at which, you know, everybody started to say, well, you get up and speak for us. And it just, on those occasions, you know, I was hot-blooded and young, and I got up and did it. So
what do you see your role as now?
Well, I'm trying to become more an not only an elder statesman, but someone that can really force Indian leadership of today to look seriously at the responsibilities they have to their own people. You find when you get a lot of media attention that leaders of minority groups start playing to the white audiences and they forget about their constituents. And eventually they get cut down by their constituents because they're not really relating to the community anymore. And I've tried to get younger Indians to see that one of the main problems we have with white society is a lack of information. Indians don't understand very much about white society, and whites know virtually nothing about Indians. So they're a very, very, very important role for this generation of Indians is to produce a lot of people who understand both cultures and can interpret back and forth. You know, what do these things mean? And so I run a graduate program at the University of Arizona. I try to recruit students who I think fit that mold and be able to do those things.
Fine. Deloria is my guest, if you're just joining us, the author of Custer Died for Your Sins. And we talk, you listen, and he now teaches political science at the University of Arizona. A lot of the really stereotyped Indian images have disappeared from movies and TV programs. That's in part because of consciousness raising and in part because Westerns aren't very popular anymore.
That's right.
But how important is that now in the scheme of things? Like, on those times when, say, a made-for-TV movie or a new series starts, which has really stereotypical images that you think are very negative, how much attention do you think is worth putting in to fighting that at this point?
Well, it depends. I don't usually get upset about those kind of things because I fought those battles 20 years ago, and history's cyclical and it comes around. About 4 years ago, the traditional people in the Sioux tribe got very upset about this book, Hanta Yo. This white lady claimed that she was the only one that ever knew anything about Sioux Indians, and every other document that was ever printed didn't know anything about them. And she toured the country and had a very, very sarcastic and even ruthless attitude toward contemporary Indians. And the medicine men on the different reservations were just livid, and they started putting pressure on a number of us who were Indian scholars working in universities to speak up. And I was in a very difficult situation because I didn't want the reading public to think that you know, I was attacking her because her book had outsold my book or anything like that. And that's what some people in New York said. And so I protested the image of Indians created in the book, which was just Ayn Rand's individualism cast in buckskin. And I kept referring people to the Rosebud Medicine Men's Association, which is a very influential traditional group in South Dakota. And I said, I only protested because these people were outraged at the image of Sioux Indians. And the problem was that it was a Doubleday book, and their publicity department had just done a magnificent job. So within 3 or 4 days, the whole country had just blitzed with this. This is the first real look inside Indian culture, which was ridiculous. There were hundreds of books that were better than that, that they gave an image of Indians. This book on Rolling Thunder, where he purports to be the big medicine man of the Western Shoshones. You know, the Western Shoshones don't claim him, but there's a segment of white society that does. Some of this stuff done by this Jamaki Highwater, who's supposed to be the Indian articulator of the primal mind. I've asked all kinds of Indians, where did this guy come from? Who is he? And why does he feel he has to wear a ton of turquoise in order to be an Indian? The Indians that I associate with out west, they're traditionals and kind of progressives. Never heard the guy, never heard of him, never met him. And yet there he is on television with Bill Moyer saying Indians believe this and that. There's a book currently out called Medicine Woman, where a very good-looking blonde lady, art collector from Beverly Hills, claims to have been trained by the last Indian woman, medicine woman, in northern Canada. Those are the kind of image problems we have today. People of non-Indian background, or people that we're pretty sure are not Indians but are now claiming to be, are going through heavily populated areas of the country and claiming to have great mystical insights into what the real Indian is and the real nature of Indian life. So we get this schmaltzy religious sentimental romanticism about Indians. And the problem is that most Indians are really doing Indian things, are really too busy working in tribal affairs or working with their communities to take a tour of the East Coast and talk about Mother Earth and chipmunks and all of these things. So we don't find hardly any image of Indians at all in the movies. I mean, as you say, Western movies are just about shot. Every now and then on some of the police shows on television, you get some dislocated Indian in the city who wants to burn incense and talk to eagles, and either Barney Miller or somebody else has to help him adjust. And that's partially, incidents like that can and do occur, so I don't think anybody has any objections to Indians appearing in that light. it's not wholly accurate, but it's much closer than what we've ever seen visually. But our big problem today is in the field of publishing. Publishers will go to extravagant lengths to publicize a book by non-Indians that purports to be the truth about Indians. And we have a lot of good Indian writers out there that really never get a chance to articulate the Indian thing. We're pretty sure that, at least in university presses and probably commercial presses, there's a racial quota that you can do one book by an Indian every 2 years, and that's it. But you can do a multitude of books by whites on their idea of what Indians are, and that's where all the money's put in publicity.
Could I ask you for a few books that you'd recommend to readers?
The John Neihardt books, Black Elk Speaks and When the Tree Flowered, they were done in the 30s, are still regarded as the classic books. D. Brown, who's a non-Indian but a very thorough scholar, his Creek Mary's Blood, which is a multi-generational novel on the Cherokees, is very highly regarded by Indian people. Stay Away Joe by Dan Cushman. It's an old book, about 30 or 40 years old. And is very popular. Indians regard that as a very accurate novelistic interpretation of life in a reservation. Frank Waters' books, The Book of the Hopi, Mass Gods, The Man Who Killed the Deer, very highly regarded by Indians and non-Indians. There's a book by a man who grew up in Philadelphia, Father Peter Powell, who now lives in Chicago, People of the Sacred Mountain, which is a very, very thorough study of the Cheyenne people and their religion and their political history. It won the National Book Award, and it won the Annisfield Wolf Award last year. It's a very expensive book, but it's just gorgeous, and it's probably as accurate as anything ever put on a printed page will be. Leslie Silko, who's a Pueblo writer, has got this book, Ceremony, which is very highly regarded by Indian people. Jim Welch, who's a Grovan from Montana, has a number of novels out. Winter in the Blood is one of those, and it's very highly regarded. So there's a lot of good literature around.
You're currently in Philadelphia to speak at and attend a conference at the Holiday Inn. What are some of the issues being talked out now at this conference?
Well, it's a combination of a review of the past 100 years in which Indian Rights Association has participated in an analysis of today's problems. I'm astounded, and everyone was astounded as the conference started yesterday, that the Indian Rights Association seems to be the sole neutral forum left in the United States where people of vastly differing philosophies can come and be friends and gather and not politicize things. We got people at that conference who've not spoken to each other in public for several years, including several Indians that hadn't talked to me and I hadn't talked to them in several years, and one of them 7 years, who felt under the auspices of the Indian Rights Association that they could come together and discuss things without getting in a political hassle. Indian Rights Association is 100 years old. It's the oldest continuing organization working in the field of Indian affairs. It has just an incredible list of accomplishments over a 100-year period. I mean, they've been active in a great many things. And during these 2 days, we have probably the best collection of scholars that's been gathered together in the last 20 years to talk about Indian things. I mean, everybody there is at the absolute top of the profession. And so it's a very exciting thing to be a part of.
Thanks for taking some time out of the conference to spend with us this afternoon. Thanks very much.
Thank you.